Elementary school classes have been back for a couple of weeks now, and as the bells ring for a class, a local school district is seeing a rise in disruptive students. Medford school districts say that there is a large rise of violent and disruptive students in our elementary schools. This has proven to be a problem across the country. Medford Education Association President Troy Pomeroy and Dr. Todd Bloomquist, who is leading the trauma-informed efforts with the Grants Pass School District, join us to discuss the rise in student outbursts in the classroom and what is being done to mitigate it. Good morning, gentlemen, and welcome to The Exchange.
I'm not a doctor, but...
Okay, Troy. Very good. Well, I'd like to ask a little bit about this. I'm sure all of us have seen that thing that's been floating around for years that where they asked teachers in the 1940s and 50s what the big problem was in the classroom, and they listed things like chewing gum. I think we've come a long ways from gum chewing as a problem in schools, but what's happening in the elementary schools, is this a sudden increase in recent years? Have we gradually been seeing an increase in disruptive behavior? I'll start with you, Todd, or Troy.
Yeah, you know, so from my perspective, I've been a teacher for almost 30 years, and this is a new phenomenon. We've had disruptive incidents before, but they were usually, you know, high school age kids, middle school age kids. You'd see an occasional fight or something, or some bullying, and schools have done a really good job getting a beat on that. We run anti-bullying campaigns, made our schools a lot safer for the older kids. What's interesting right now is this phenomenon of very young children, like 5 years old, or kindergartners are the ones we're hearing about this most, that are just completely disrupting and destroying classrooms. And it's becoming epidemic, honestly.
Do we know what the problem is?
You mean the cause?
Yeah, the cause of why we're seeing this kind of disruptive behavior.
There's a lot of theories. I don't know that we know for sure. Some people point to discipline in the home. Some people point to too much screen time. And some people point to adverse childhood experiences. Kids are traumatized coming to school and not knowing how to deal with that when they are around other people.
So in the classroom, when something disruptive happens, what's the typical procedure that a teacher will go through to try to mitigate that situation?
Well, of course, the teacher's always working with kids and trying to get to know them, make connections, and learning how to gently coax them into not, you know, blowing up or disrupting. And so they do everything they can, but when this happens, it's sort of uncontrollable. And so our response, unfortunately, our hands are tied, and that's what I'm really concerned about this is, you know, so imagine a five-year-old who, you know, has one of these episodes, and they become violent. They become loud, they scream, they yell, they might assault people, you know, kick, bite, scratch, hit. They go around the room, you know, tipping things over, throwing desks, throwing chairs, tipping tables over, ripping things off walls and destroying things in the classroom. And so our response, because of what we're set up for, is we can't remove that child from the classroom. We can't restrain them. There's not a lot of consequences that happen, honestly. What we have to do is have everybody else. So imagine 25 to 30 other students and their teacher have to leave the room. We call it a room clear. And they have to leave the room and let this child de-escalate, which might take, you know, 20 minutes, 30 minutes, maybe longer. And then when that child is calmed down, we send somebody in who's trained to come coax them out, and they go to a timeout or something. And then these children come back in and have to put the room back together with the help of their teacher and the staff, and then try to actually get some learning done the rest of that day, which, as you can imagine, probably isn't very likely if you've been witnessed this traumatic event, right? And so that's what we're up against. It's called a room clear, and unfortunately, when a child does this, they're brought right back into the classroom usually. Sometimes they'll do this 3 or 4 times in a day. And if that doesn't happen, you know, they're taken home that day and counseled and talked to and stuff. They're back in the classroom the next day. So we've had, you know, room clears that might happen 8 to 14 times in a row, 8 to 14 days in a row before we can get help for that child.
Now, I understand that in certain situations, a child can be restrained. Is that correct?
But it's rare, and the law has something to do with imminent harm, and imminent harm is defined as generally something pretty severe, like the person's actually going to die, you know. And that's not usually the case if a kid's throwing things, and it can still be really disruptive before we're allowed to do much with that child.
Joining us also is Dr. Todd Bloomquist from Grants Pass, and I wanted to ask for your perspective on this, what you're seeing as well.
Well, good morning, everybody, and thanks for having me on the air. Hi, Troy. How are you doing?
Good, Todd. Good to hear your voice.
Yeah, you too, brother. So in Grants Pass schools, we were seeing similar things. You know, I track our data for the district pretty closely on the numbers of incidences where children are out of control. And we're spending a lot of time focusing on the why. Why is there an increase to behavior issues coming into the school system? What's going on sort of underneath all that we can see? There's a lot of things that are going on. So our approach, not dissimilar to what Troy just described, where we are literally having to evacuate a classroom until a student can come back to self-control. And so we're trying to implement strategies, they're called socio-emotional strategies, that are very targeted toward the brain development and maturity level of the student. And one of the things we're finding success with is when we spend more time with that child who's having trouble regulating, is teaching them how to regulate. And we haven't found any child yet, when taught how to regulate, that isn't incredibly happy to have that gift of self-control. A lot of children are what we call quick triggers, where their stress response system to the environment, which actually just may be because there's a lot of children in the classroom, that may be enough for a child's stress response pathways to trigger extra doses of adrenaline and cortisol in the system, which can put a child into sort of that fight, flight, or freeze mentality state that actually Troy was just describing, which is really, there's very, very difficult to reason with somebody at that stage. And so it takes about 20 minutes for adrenaline and cortisol to dissipate out of the system. And so for that child to start accessing their thinking part of their brain or their cortex. And in those moments, we're working to develop plans so that the child recognizes when he or she is going to be triggered. They often can tell just ahead of time when their heart rate increases or they're feeling pressure inside, and then to do something physical to help them regulate. But it is becoming an increasing problem. We have seen in our kindergarten classrooms where we might have one or two children that we would call that are hyper-dysregulated like that. Last year, I had the majority of my kindergarten classrooms. It wasn't uncommon to have 7, 8, 9, 10, or in one case, 11 children that were almost always out of control of themselves.
Is this is there a danger in labeling a child too soon? Do you really need to take it slow to make sure that you get a correct diagnosis and a correct treatment program?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. in running the special education program here for a number of years in Grants Pass, we recognize that a number of the eligibility diagnoses that children would have for special education programs to get that label that you just talked about, a lot of that comes from the environment. So children are adapting to their environment. Lives are pretty complicated in the Valley. And so if we can help that child early on in preschool, kindergarten, first grade, learn how to regulate so that when they are becoming dysregulated, they themselves can get themselves under control. You'll see an actual decrease in eligibility because children are able to maintain. And the earlier we can do that with children, the better it is. You can certainly do it as a teenager, and even as an adult, you can learn how to do this, but it's just harder. And so we're focusing on all age groups, but really particularly those elementary ones to help them learn how to regulate so that they don't have to be labeled as oppositional defiance disorder or emotionally disturbed or something like that. And then they will be able to access content at a much earlier state. So that's kind of what we're working on.
We're speaking this morning with Dr. Todd Bloomquist from the Grants Pass School District and Troy Pomeroy, president of the Medford Education Association. If you have a question, if you'd like to join our conversation, 800-838-3760, or you can send us an email at jx@jeffnet.org. Tell me a little bit about the IEPs. Now, that's an individualized education program. Did I get that right?
Yeah, that's correct.
And how do those help with students?
So to have an eligibility for special education, what has to happen is that I think all the schools in Southern Oregon are doing something called response to intervention. So as the children come into the school, if they're not picking up the content at a rate that we think that they should be, then we might start trying other ways of educating them, different modalities, ways to help them access the content and to store it in their minds and in their bodies. And if that's still not happening, then we might start doing assessments on them. And there might be a true learning disability. It might have to do with the way that the brain takes in sound and processes it, sometimes called an auditory processing deficit. It may be a problem with the way that the neural pathways have developed, and there's an actual cognition problem, any number of ways. And so to have an individual education plan means that a student needs specially designed instruction. And so what our teachers do then is we meet as a team with the family, and we work out ways to help that child overcome whatever it is that they're struggling with so they can get access to the content. And so that's called specially designed instruction. So that's pretty much the biggest difference between that and just a regular education plan for anybody else.
Do we have alternative type classrooms locally? I'm thinking back a long, long time ago when I lived in a different part of the country. My daughter was put into first grade, and it was what they called an open classroom with no desks, and she did not like that at all, if you knew her personality. So a week or two later, we moved her back into a traditional classroom, and she thrived. And so do we have those kind of options for kids who may be stressed in certain kind of environments?
You know, there are some options in public schools. We still kind of have that one-size-fits-all model, unfortunately. And so what we're, I think, across the boards trying to do in Oregon right now is to attend to children that don't thrive in that what we call a traditional classroom environment, might need something different. So you do see occasionally different open designs like that. You do see the increase in charter school programs. And a charter school is still a public school. It's under the umbrella of a school district. But they might propose a different methodology, kind of like what you suggested, either an open classroom or a different philosophical approach to education, a developmental approach, that kind of a thing, to attend to some children. Just that environment just doesn't work well for them. And other kids, you put them in that alternative environment, and that doesn't work for them, just like you said. And so what we try to do is have a variety of options. Predominantly, though, I would say in Oregon public schools, you know, most children are going to go through kind of a traditional classroom with desks and things like that. Where we're starting to see a difference is attending to students who have attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, sometimes called ADHD. And that simply means that I've probably either grown up in an environment where my world is pretty chaotic. There might be some adversity there. And so my brain is adapted to that and is ready to respond. And so I kind of have difficulty focusing on one thing. I might want to focus on five or six things all at the same time. So an adaptation would be to have children, instead of sitting in a traditional chair, they might sit on a chair that's contained in a little frame, but it's basically a bouncy ball. And so the child can sit on the bouncy ball, and that puts your core kind of always in motion a little bit. Even just that little bit of motion will sometimes allow that child's brain to focus on mathematics or writing or whatever it is they're being taught that day. So things like that we're trying to do.
I'm sure you could both answer this question. I wanted to ask Troy, though, with the Medford Education Association. Understandably, parents kind of immediately panic when their children start to have a particular problem. And how do you respond to parents who are a little bit impatient at seeing either a diagnosis or a plan that's going to work well for them?
That you've hit it nail on the head there. It is a tough process. It does take some time to do it effectively. You know, like you mentioned, not diagnosing too early. So there's a process, and that's why sometimes the student is in class, repeatedly disrupting class for days on end, because they're still observing, trying different modifications, like some of the things Todd mentioned. But really, honestly, the concern, that is a big concern. It just takes too long. Meanwhile, here's what's ironic about that. You know, the student that's causing this disruption is what I call a broken kid. And I say that with a great amount of compassion. Todd mentioned that sometimes, you know, just a family situations are not ideal. And so this kid comes in with some trauma, and they don't know how to act appropriately, and we're doing things for those, and Tom is mentioning those. But meanwhile, this student is, you know, assaulting people, kids and staff, and destroying classrooms and doing that repeatedly. You should see the effect that has on the other students. We have little five-year-old girls that will hide under desks because they know this person is about to escalate into one of these episodes again. And so now you have these people that haven't witnessed this kind of behavior. All of a sudden, they're having trauma. You know, it's ironic that, you know, a trauma-affected child will then cause their classmates to have trauma. It's taking too long. We need alternative settings. We need a faster approach to getting help for these kids that are doing this and relief for the students that they're causing harm to and the staff as well.
Is there some kind of alternative empty classroom, and I know this is probably a foolish question when there's everything is so tight, it seems, but an alternative classroom that the child can go to for a period of time where the rest of the students can go to? When you herd the students out of the room while the kid is escalating, what do you do with those children in that time frame?
You know, it varies by school, and it's kind of an elementary issue. Some schools are having safe places, rooms that are, you know, more suited to de-escalating a child so they can be put there with the other students. You know, I don't really have firsthand experience on what happens with them. Maybe Todd can answer that from his perspective.
Yeah, I sure can. So one of the strategies we've tried to employ is having a room in our elementary and actually our middle schools as well. Just called the Learning Center. And so it's got a number of different tasks that are on that particular room. It's staffed by a pretty engaging individual. And essentially it's a place, it's a quiet place, it's a calm place. And I mentioned earlier about students that come from adversity that might be quick triggers and helping them learn how to get control of themselves. One of those strategies is when the child recognizes that they're going to go, kind of like the other children recognize when that children's going to go too, before they end up in a fully escalated event, that they get out to that learning center where they can get engaged in other activities that will help calm them down. Sometimes they're physical. We're finding out in the brain research that rhythm has a lot to do with regulation of the body. It kind of makes sense when you say it out loud, but mm-hmm. We don't necessarily practice regulation strategies. That could come from music. It could come from drumming, even as simple as taking a walk. And what we know is that getting a child in an environment where there's a rhythm or a beat, and the first beat that we attune to is our mother's heartbeat in the womb. And so that 60 to 70 beats per minute is a very calming thing for just about everybody. And so that's a strategy we're employing so that children have a place to go to get calmed down, and so that event that might happen, that where we have to clear a classroom, doesn't happen in the classroom. It can happen someplace else. Conversely, that if we have to clear a classroom, the Learning Center could be a place where that the other children could go to.
We're speaking this morning with Dr. Todd Bloomquist, who is leading the trauma-informed efforts at the Grants Pass School District, and also Troy Pomeroy from the Medford Education Association. If you have a question you'd like to ask them, we're talking about an increase in disruption at the elementary level in classrooms. Our number, 800-838-3760, or you can send us an email at jx@jeffnet.org. When I was a boy, I was a little hyper, and my mother's solution was, you know, to say, Milton Jr., go outside and play. And so that's what I did, burn off some energy. Are we looking at sort of modern educational alternatives to what my mother used to tell me to do?
I think we are doing that exact thing. Sometimes it's a good idea to get out and not to have recess, per se, but to have organized, constructed physical activity where children are practicing regulation, they're practicing skills that are more physical, because all of our bodies are designed to move. And I think for a lot of our children, you know, 2 out of 3 children are affected in some way by adversity. So their bodies and minds have adapted to that adversity. So they tend to be pretty quick, pretty, I gotta move all the time sort of statements happen. You can see it in the classroom. And so having that physical activity is definitely a positive thing. So yeah, I think in some sense, your mom was right on.
Are we putting an increase in pressure on younger kids today compared to, you know, when I was young? Is that part of the problem? Is it just feels like there's too much going on in their lives?
You know, I think we interview our children or survey them actually quite often, and we are seeing an increase in students younger and younger saying that they're stressed out, that they have too much to do or whatever. And there's a correlation with it used to be just called it, you know, TV time. You know, instead of watching TV, get out and play, like your mom said. This is more about the interactive devices, smartphones or tablets. Mm-hmm. Younger and younger children, parents are giving them to children to just keep them preoccupied, if nothing else. And neurologically, that's not how the brain is designed to grow and learn. And so we think that that may be part of what's going on here, where rather than getting out and playing or doing something physical, kids are spending a lot more time behind some kind of device. Mm-hmm. Even if it's an educational game or something like that, which can be beneficial, there are limits to that, and we want to be mindful, and we're trying to help parents know. So about how long should a student be on a device to be playing or doing something, even educationally? And then we need to give our eyes a break. The optic nerve is very sensitive to how often our devices are refreshing, and it can make us our eyes tired, can even give us headaches, those kinds of things. So I think, you know, those are some of the things we're looking into as ways to kind of combat some of the increase in behaviors that are happening. But stress alone, again, kids are saying they're feeling more stressed out. They pick up a lot of that stress from their parents. And so we have a lot of parents who are struggling. We live in a community that has been noted even nationally as having lots of poverty issues. When you have money issues in your home, it stresses the home environment out. And so kids pick up on that. They pick up on, they're very good receptors of what's going on around them. So I think they're bringing that into their world as well. When mom and dad are stressed, then the child is saying, well, I'm stressed too then. So I think it's all of that together.
I was going to ask a question about resources with this increase. The two of you are in two different districts. What are you? Are we allocating more resources to handle this? Is that a problem? Is there a money crunch to provide all of the available help that's needed? What's happening from the money side of things?
Well, I can talk about Grants Pass. We definitely are reallocating dollars to attend to social-emotional needs of children. And so one of our partners is Options for Southern Oregon, and that's the county mental health programs. And we have an options counselor that's specifically in each building for kids that are really struggling. So that might be more of a therapeutic thing that they're working on with the family. But we're also purchasing more of those qualified mental health specialists into our schools, giving them just time to work with kids so that kids that are struggling with that those kinds of behaviors and self-control, that they're actually getting coaching throughout their school day. We are developing some after-school intensive training programs for little guys that cannot make it through a day. And so we're actually finding some great success. They're very expensive because you've got a teacher, you've got a couple of well-trained support aides, and an options therapist that are working with, you know, 4 to 8 children at a time to give them tools.
Well, I'd like to thank Dr. Todd Bloomquist from the Grants Pass School District and Troy Pomeroy, president of the Medford Education Association, for visiting with us this morning regarding disruptive behavior in the classrooms and efforts to make an improvement. Gentlemen, thank you for being here.